Thank you, Judge. If the court will permit, I was going to address the post-judgment interest issues, and my co-counsel and partner Genevieve Nichols would address the trial issues, unless the questioning takes us otherwise, obviously.
And you've been advised that you need to monitor your time.
Yes. We're roughly trying to split the half. We know that won't work.
Great.
But
thank
anyway,
you.
So the main issues I would like to highlight today are the straight statutory construction outside of the constitutional issues. The statute upon which the trial court and St. Anthony's of the trial court apparently relied, and St. Anthony's urged to deny post-judgment interest to the Mr. Deeser, a patient who prevailed in his malpractice case against St. Anthony's, was 538-300, I'm sure the court is aware, which says that sections 2 and 3 of the general interest statute, 408-010, do not apply to cases brought under the malpractice, brought under Chapter 538. As the court knows from reading the brief, the current version, or the version of 538-300, says nothing about Section 1 of the general interest statute. The statute is in the appendix, or second appendix at page A3, but Section 1, which 538-300 does not reach, says, judgments shall accrue interest on the judgment balance as set forth in this section. The judgment balance is defined as the total amount of the judgment awarded on the day judgment is entered, including but not limited to principal and other items. St. Anthony says that version is only instructional. I'm not sure exactly what that means, and that it did not intend to confer any rights at all. St. Anthony's also says that 538-300, which says Section 2 and 3 are not applicable to malpractice cases, was clearly intended to deny post-judgment interest to successful malpractice plaintiffs. However, if you look at the bill summary of HB 393 in 2005, it says nothing at all about denying a new denial of post-judgment interest to malpractice plaintiffs. Commentators, I put a couple of law review articles from the Missouri Bar back at the time in the appendices. Commentators didn't notice it, and courts went on giving post-judgment interest in malpractice cases up until really August of 2014 in the Mackey decision. Really, I don't know if any of you were practicing malpractice back in 2005, but no one thought back at the time that post-judgment interest was being taken away. We all knew back from way back when in the 87 that pre-judgment interest did not apply. Also, St. Anthony's relies on this argument that the 2014 version, which added the Section 1 upon which I rely for the straight statutory construction argument, you know, did not intend to confer any new rights. And he bases that, St. Anthony's bases that on a summary of Senate Bill 631 that says it was intended to define judgment balance. I don't know who writes summaries. I expect it's legislative staff, like maybe your staff writes.
What is the effect of legislative summaries on the statutes?
I think none, Your Honor. I don't think they're written by the legislature, but the title of the act, however, as opposed to the legislative summary in Senate Bill, I think it's 631, that put this subsection 1 in upon which I rely was an act to repeal various sections, including the general interest statute, but not 538-300, an act to repeal the general interest statutes and replace new judicial procedures in lieu thereof. That's exactly what they did in Section 1, if 538-300 is interpreted to deny post-judgment interest in cases brought under Chapter 538.
What does it mean if just subsection 1, then, under your interpretation, would apply to tort cases and 2 and 3 would not? How do we give it effect? How is it applied?
I think you mean to malpractice cases,
yes.
Your Honor. If 1 applies in 2 and 3, first of all, I'd point out that we disagree with the Mackey decision that malpractice cases are brought under Chapter 538. As this Court has said numerous times, malpractice cases are brought under the common law. But given that stands, That leaves us with no rate, I have to admit, on post-judge. If Section 1 gives post-judgment interest in malpractice and in all cases, including malpractice cases, then 538.300 in saying subsection 3, which supplies the rate, does not apply. Then we have no rate.
And prior to there being a statute setting the rate, how do courts determine post-judgment interest?
In situation, I've cited a couple of cases in Vincent Forever, in Vincent, way back Vincent, not way back, 96 or whatever it was.
Not so far back.
Yeah, I know, I'm feeling it. In Vincent, I think at that time they were discussing the post-judgment interest for future installment payments under the Malpractice Act, which you all, I know, are aware of. But at that time, the statute did not set the rate. It just said there should be post-judgment interest and there should be a hearing on it and the judge should decide the amount of interest. So in equity courts, we'll apply rates, we'll apply interest and rates without statutory authority, and we'll apply rates without when there's no rate involved. And in Vincent, when there was a rate, when there was interest authorized statutorily but no rate, it was up to the judge's discretion. So that's my argument on how we get to a rate. It seems to me, and I don't know, anyway, I'll skip that, but it seems to me that the legislature, kind of like the hats going under the baseballs at the ball game, lost track of where the subsections were moving around in all of this. As currently applied, if the 538 statute applies, what it says now is that the subsection that applies to non-tort actions does not apply to malpractice, which makes no sense at all. So somewhere there's been confusion in the shifting subsections. Maybe it happened in 2005 when they didn't realize that the general grant post-judgment interest in all cases had been pushed down to subsection 3, and 538.300, which said subsection 3 doesn't apply, but at that time only applied to pre-judgment interest. Maybe they didn't realize that post-judgment interest got moved down there, and then 538 caught it. Or maybe in 2014 they didn't realize that subsection 1, you know, wasn't reached by 538, and now they're saying 3 and 4.
What do we make of the language in subsection 1 that says judgment shall accrue interest on the judgment balance as set forth in this section?
And the next section defines judgment balance to include the judgment,
the next
amount
sentence,
of the judgment on the day that it's awarded.
So you're saying the next sentence provides
next
meaning
sentence
to that
provides,
as set forth
yes.
in this section?
That would be my argument. It's fully, I'm relying on that. With respect to the constitutional arguments, I still got a little time halfway. Limited time, I would highlight my argument on the Watts case and the jury trial right. As I'm sure the court is acutely aware, the Watts case said that once a jury trial attaches, the jury's assessment of damages should be free from hostile legislation. The second part of the opinion that discussed, again, the post-judgment interest that's provided for malpractice cases when the judgment says you have to pay in the future, right? The future medical, the future damages that are put in the installment plan, they provide post-judgment interest there, but at a very low rate. And the on-bank second portion of the opinion said that the too low interest rate provided by the statute could deprive the plaintiff of the full value of the jury's award, recognizing in that case a young child, I think it was, and recognizing that the future needs of an individual plaintiff are going to be variable, that the jury had to reduce to present value the future damages. And unless those two interest rates are consistent with each other, then you're by definition depriving the plaintiff of the full value of the jury's award. I think the recognition was that the court interpreted that statute in a way to avoid any constitutional concerns of intrusion on the right to the full value of the jury's award by a too low interest rate. And in this case, you're presented with no interest at all on a case, you know, reduced to present value, because the jury has to, and you're getting no interest at all on it. I believe a close reading of Watts suggests that the jury trial right attaches even to intrusions based on too low, I would argue, absent post-judgment interest. With reference to our open courts and equal protection argument, both of those come down at a minimum. I know, you know, there's no strict scrutiny to malpractice victims, not saying that. I was arguing a fundamental property right, cited a case to the court where the U.S. Supreme Court gave post-judgment interest as a matter of fair compensation under the U.S. Constitution. And I guess that would require some stricter scrutiny than just rational relationship. But let's just go with rational relationship right now. Both analyses, both open courts and rational and equal protection, I believe, depend on a rational relationship. Am I almost at 12 minutes? I'm going to stop. I would just point out that the rational relationship is, why are you denying post-judgment interest to judgment amounts past due, but giving post-judgment interest to judgment amounts that are due in the future under the installment payment part of Chapter 538. I left the 24th.
I'm not their biggest point, I think, is this idea about the never events. And I would point out, obviously, the biggest thing is that I don't believe that they could show prejudice on any of these things, because the jury was properly instructed that they had to find negligence before they could find damages. And under the law, you're required to presume that the jury properly found those instructions. If that's the case, whether or not they believed anything about the never events and any of the testimony becomes somewhat irrelevant, given that they properly found negligence. There's no challenge to the submissibility of the case. There is ample evidence that we put on that they fell below the standard of care, and that it caused the damages. Am I using up the 3 minutes now?
You're not. But we'll hear from you on rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge Fix.
May it please the court and counsel. I have my argument today planned out as best I can, but I invite questions, obviously, from the court at any time. I hope to be able to answer those to the best of my ability. I'll start, though, first with the main point that Ms. Coffey mentioned, which is about this post-judgment interest challenge that the plaintiff has made in this case. I think we've briefed it well. I don't have a whole lot. I'm not going to walk through all the detail. All I would say is I think the statutory language, the statutes are clear in what they say. We did mention the bill summary in our trial briefing as well as before this court, but a bill summary is just a bill summary. And the statute's language is where it's at. I think clearly.
Well, can you address, they added the words. They didn't just add a definition of judgment balance, so it's more than a definition. They specifically added in 2014 the phrase judgment shall accrue interest on the judgment balance as set forth in this section. And then they don't negate the application of that to malpractice cases. Are you asking us to read that out? In effect, you're saying that adds nothing to the statute.
I don't think it adds, I think it adds something to the statute. I think what it adds is what they want. Someone apparently wanted to be sure that, just like anybody pays on a loan on a reducing balance, I think what the legislature wanted to do here was make sure that somebody who's paying interest on a judgment is paying on a reducing balance basis. That's what that language says to me. And
well, that's what the definition of judgment balance says to you, but you're asking us to read the statute as if that first sentence before the definition of judgment balance weren't there, aren't you? Because you're saying it reads the same with or without it in this circumstance.
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think really the fact is that most judgments do bear interest. And so I think that fact is true. What the exclusionary provision involves here is what really goes on in Section 3, and so of 408.040. And so I think that's where the imposition of the interest really gets put on the judgment.
And it didn't exclude, I mean, I'd like you to address more directly. It didn't exclude from the application of malpractice actions of this statement, which they specifically added in 2014.
Yes, Your Honor.
Judgment shall accrue interest on the judgment balance as set forth in this section. It doesn't say sometimes or in most cases or anything. It says that. And I understand you're saying, well, that doesn't really add anything. It doesn't have any meaning without subsections, if subsections 2 and 3 don't apply. But then why did they add it? What meaning does it give that wouldn't, the statute wouldn't have without that sentence? Because we always try to give meaning to every word in a statute.
What this says, I think, clearly is that this is the setup to tie Section 1 into the rest of the statute. Basically, it says this statute talks about interest on judgments.
It doesn't say that it accrues judgment, accrues interest as set forth in this subsection. It's referencing the entirety of this section.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think we have to read, obviously, maximum of statutory construction is you read the entire statute, not just a phrase. That's what the plaintiff wants to do, is focus on this one phrase that says this interest is going to be on these judgments. But the fact is, all it says is, this is the setup. They're saying, look, here's how it's going to go. You're going to reduce this judgment balance, and here's how we define it. It's just that simple and straightforward. And so I don't think there's any question. Plus, what the plaintiff is asking to do is to say that the General Assembly didn't realize what they were doing, or that they did something meaningless, or that they did something absurd. And of course, those are all maxims of construction I don't have to tell the court about in terms of what would make sense here, what would the General Assembly most likely be trying to accomplish. And they're really just trying to accomplish the fact that they want to change the way in which the judgment balance is bearing interest. And I think it's just that straightforward and simple. I hope I've answered that, Judge Steph.
Thank you.
So in terms of the constitutional issues that the plaintiffs have raised, I guess I need to kind of go from the back end first. Ms. Coffey mentioned that she wanted to rely on the Watts case and its discussion of 538.220.2. I would point out to the court, this is a situation of a challenge to the constitutional validity of a statute, and that argument was raised for the first time in plaintiff's reply brief in this court. This is an argument now that permeates in the plaintiff's reply brief, both the initial, what I'll call the substantive point about 408.040 and what it reaches, as well as the constitutional challenges. And it's seen most markedly in the right to jury trial challenge. That is the third constitutional challenge, where plaintiff pretty much discusses only the Watts case and now shifts the discussion from being subsets of the population at large with judgments versus negligence plaintiffs with judgments in those cases to comparing what happens under the denial of judgment interest under 538.300 and 538.220.2, which is what we refer to commonly as the periodic payment statute. That's a whole different ball of wax, I think. I can address that as well on the merits, but I want to make clear that I'm not waiving the fact that I don't think this has been preserved. I will say, though, that there is a rational basis for that distinction. In the one case, the legislature decided that for the non-periodic...
Why are they required to raise that until they obtain a judgment?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You're suggesting they would have to raise the constitutional issue in their reply?
Well, I think they should have raised it somewhere before this court, Judge, because I think it could have been aired out at this point. We don't even have the opportunity to file a written response to it, quite frankly. And the rule, I know, is one that seems a little harder to figure out than it maybe it ought to be, about raising constitutional challenges at the first opportunity and keeping them preserved throughout. But this
When do you think was the first opportunity that it could be raised?
I think it could have been raised at the trial court level before Judge Burton and given him an opportunity.
When specifically? After judgment and a motion for a new trial, prior to the time they obtained a judgment, in the reply to some answer, in a motion for summary judgment. I mean, all sorts of things happen. Realistically would you be expected to raise this to the trial court when it really mattered?
What do I think? I think it must be raised when the opposing party, whichever the issue is, basically props up the issue itself. So I would say, in this case, I'm sure we raise it in affirmative defenses, the medical malpractice provisions, even though they're really not affirmative defenses. It's been the practice for years to raise those as affirmative defenses, and I think there's plenty of case law that would say at the first opportunity, which means when the issue raises its head, someone needs to raise it. Now, does that mean it can be fully fleshed out at that point? No, that's not the point. The point is to give the opportunity to the parties and to the court at the trial court level to fully air it out And sometimes maybe nothing much needs to be aired out. And I grant that. I really do. But for example, in this case, plaintiff argues that there's no rational basis for Section 538.300 and its barring of interest on post-judgment interest on these judgments. They haven't produced any evidence anywhere about the lack of rationality. They've just said it's irrational, it doesn't make sense. And that's not how the challenge goes. They have to have something to show that, in fact, it's an irrational, absurd statute. For example, so I've just raised that as one example of something that could be raised at that level to allow it. And here, for this 538.220.2 argument, Judge Burton didn't even have the opportunity to pass on one way or the other. I'm not suggesting I know exactly how much of an opportunity he would have had, but he didn't have any. Be that as it may, I do think there's a rational basis for the General Assembly to distinguish between 538.300 and its preclusion of post-judgment interest and 538.220.2. That's an occasion where the defendant asks for the periodic payments, which could take out over decades. It could be 40 years before those dollars are finally paid. And so the General Assembly, no doubt, in a trade-off, decided, well, if it's going to be that, if you're going to want that provision, then here's what's going to have to happen. It's going to have to bear interest for 40 years. I mean, we're not just going to let you hang on to this money. It's not going to happen. And that's why I think. So I think there is a rational basis for that, but I wanted to make that point. I wanted to make that point clear. In terms of the constitutional challenges, I think we've addressed those fully throughout in terms of why this plaintiff has not carried his burden on the equal protection argument. Clearly, plaintiffs in medical negligence cases are not a suspect class. The post-judgment interest is statutory, so it's not a constitutional right. There is a rational basis for that, and the plaintiffs have not shown otherwise.
Can you address the never events issue?
I sure can, Your Honor. I'm glad you asked that. And the one thing I wanted to say about the only never events in this case was that the plaintiffs were never going to produce a Centers for Medicare regulation that said that a pressure ulcer was a never event. So this from the very, even from before trial started, it was clear that plaintiff's counsel wanted to get into this idea of a never event from the Medicare.
Your defense was that it was unavoidable. Why wasn't it relevant for them to bring in evidence that it was avoidable, whether or not it's a regulation?
I think the distinction here, Your Honor, at least in my view, is this is talking about the power. They implied more than once, both to Judge Burton and in front of the jury, cross-examined my nurse expert, Dr. Krasner, that isn't there a regulation that CMS, Medicare, has generated that says pressure ulcers in the hospital should never happen? That's what they
purported. So you're saying the prejudice was not that they said, well, there's evidence that it's not reimbursable because they think it shouldn't happen, but that they implied it was more than it was, it was a regulation, and that was the prejudice?
I think that's part of it, Judge. I don't mean to, for example, I think if the battle was simply, we think it's unavoidable, and they think that in the lingo somewhere, there's this never event thing, okay, that's one thing. I would have objected to that still, I would have. But this is very different. Now we've got the power of the power of the federal government's health agency saying, This should never happen. It's a blanket decision.
Is it correct that the federal government won't reimburse for these because they think they're avoidable?
Well, here's one of the issues in the case, Judge. The regulation or the ruling that would have held that wouldn't have been in effect until October of 2008, which is about 6 months after the health care in this case. And so now I was stuck at trial with the situation of dealing with something. So there never was a Medicare regulation that said pressure ulcers are never events that should never happen. It did get into reimbursement, which we think gets into insurance, Your Honor. Reimbursement is a whole other world. This has nothing to do with the civil litigation. And there was no evidence in this case, I might point out, that St. Anthony's was not reimbursed for the health care provided to Mr. Deeser on any level, whether for the pressure ulcer or not. And so even the facts that they would have needed to show, in fact, the hospital wasn't reimbursed. In fact, Medicare did frown on this. The evidence isn't there. And so I was fighting a little bit of a ghost throughout this whole process of trying to figure out what I'm dealing with. And now, you know, I think the plaintiff's response would be, well, you had an opportunity to straighten it out with your expert. Well, now we're talking about basically some event. Let's assume that there would be a Medicare event, a Medicare regulation, 6 months down the road. Well, now I'm talking about a kind of a safety rule that isn't in effect yet. And I'm having to explain to a jury.
Did you bring in evidence of the viewing this event is unavoidable from after the date of her injury or only from before?
I think there was a...
Didn't your expert talk about definitions and so forth that were long after? So you were saying whether it's avoidable or unavoidable, you didn't make this distinction you're now drawing between when...
My expert did talk, Your Honor, right, about generally about there being a definition of unavoidable pressure ulcers. That had to do, though, I think with, first of all, not a federal, no federal standard that said this is unavoidable. We didn't bring that in. I don't think we would have been allowed to. Mm-hmm. But I think that is talking about definitions. And that is really about medical causation. That is, what does the medical community understand about the physiology of pressure ulcers and how they occur? And unavoidable pressure ulcers, we talk about deep tissue injury, which is not the conventional. You see it on the surface first and it goes down. Deep tissue injury is some insult deep, sometimes not even from mishandling, that starts and goes up. And I guess I liken it to a souffle that's collapsed. I mean, by the time it hits the surface, and that's what we believe Mr. Deeser had, by the time it hits the surface with a purplish color, it's already done. And so that was our defense at trial, Your Honor, in terms of that. So,
thank you.
In terms of the other issues, we've talked about the excessiveness of the verdict. I did want to mention, I think, this mention of religion. Mr. Deeser talking about having been a Catholic and feeling St. Anthony's was a Catholic institution. I think that's clearly prejudicial and clearly his call for the jury to be angry with him at what he said was a Catholic institution. That's clearly invoking religion. We don't know anything about the religious affiliations of anyone on that jury. Religion has no place in a medical malpractice case. We did not raise it at all in any way. And so I think that was something that just appealed to the emotion of the jury. We've had, like it or not, I mean, I'm a Catholic, like it or not, there's been a lot of things in the press over the last many years that has not painted a very favorable light, at least certain aspects of the Catholic religion. I mean, even as recently as last week, Archbishop Carlson writing a letter about the Girl Scouts of America detaching from parishes. And so I just think that was something that just was not, shouldn't have been in this case, period. It really left the defendant with nothing to do about it. It wasn't an issue. No one had raised it. And so I think from that standpoint, I think that alone is a prejudicial error. In closing, I would just say that I think any one of the issues we've raised as trial error would be enough to reverse the case. I do want to bring the court's attention to a specific case, which I believe could be helpful, State versus Mull, which is cited in the State v. Gardner case at 300 Southwest 511. That's a case involving improper cross-examination. That's a 1927 case from this court involving improper cross-examination, and the court basically found that through cross-examination, one shouldn't be allowed to get into inadmissible evidence under the guise of cross-examination. I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Would you send a letter to the court with that cite?
I will,
calling
Your Honor.
That to our attention and send a copy to you.
I appreciate that.
Counsel on the other side.
I will do that.
May it please the court. You know, if it's true that this isn't relevant, then why on earth did she talk about it, their expert, on direct exam? You know, this is her book that she referenced on direct, and how it went was Mr. Baker asked her, Dr. Krasner, tell us about your first opinion. And she starts talking about how no matter what anything St. Anthony's did, this was going to happen. And to my mind, as someone who tries med mal cases all the time, that's a causation argument. That's saying, you know what, no matter what we did, they do a couple of things, right? Either we didn't do it, but their big one is always, even if we did do it, it didn't matter. So she gets up there and talks about this book, and in this book it says, regulatory issues and reimbursement mechanisms have enormous impact on the quality of care. She then told the jury that based on her understandings of the definition of unavoidable from 2004, then 2010, then 2014, not just from the National Quality Forum, but specifically on direct exam, before I opened my mouth or Mary said anything about it, she said the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, we rely upon their definition of unavoidable to determine what is and is not an unavoidable pressure ulcer. So to me, the door was opened. I got up, I argued it, so the door has been opened. And the judge rightfully decided it had. This is cross-examination of an expert witness, a medical expert witness, where all the time we get up and we test the extent of their knowledge and the reliability of their opinion
by bringing to their attention contrary medical texts, medical ideas, and medical propositions all the time.
Counselor, when in regard to the constitutional argument, when did you first raise it, and when would have been the first opportunity to raise it?
Well, the first opportunity to meaningfully raise it is only after judgment. Why do we have to say anything about... And we raised it before judgment. Thank you, Mary. We raised it at the earliest opportunity. You know, Mr. Venker submitted briefs on the issue. The judge decided it. Nobody asked for any extra time to submit any extra documents. The judge took his time in deciding this and all of the
So it was issues. Raised before judgment and briefed after, or when was it raised and briefed?
It was raised and briefed.
Judgment was entered.
Well, excuse me. We'll hear
Sorry.
From the attorney.
Sorry. After, I apologize. After the verdict, before the judgment was entered, that's when the issue came up, is when proposed judgments were submitted. We said it should include interest. They said it shouldn't. And then there was a whole opportunity for briefing. There was an argument on it, as a matter of fact. I don't think there was a transcript. It was in chambers. But I'm pretty sure, it was well argued. Nobody asked for more time or leave to submit anything. Burton, the judge made his decision very carefully, as he did with the never events. The other issue, you know, I keep hounding prejudice, but obviously, you know, they have to show a clear abuse of discretion. Judge Burton took written briefings. He heard more than one offer of proof. He had this book here. He had testimony from their wound care nurse that Medicare has determined that stage 3 and 4 pressure ulcers acquired in the hospital are never events.
Doctor, excuse me, your time
I'm
is
sorry,
up.
Judge.
We will review the filings with the court as well as argument cases submitted.
Thank you, Judge.